Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Community Radio for the Northwest, KBOO, Portland. Coming up at midnight, Joe Woods presents the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. Stay tuned now for the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time.
You're entering a zone of sound and imagery. A landscape of frequency, a vocabulary of imagination. There is the signpost up ahead. Please adjust your chronometers. This is Gremlin Time.
Christopher Morley's The Railway Guide, read by Golden Whiskey.
Another book which he used to see lying in the office also caught Richard's fancy. It was a thick-bound volume, always carefully consulted by the sales boys before going off on their travels. Richard found it more to his taste than most fiction. It was called The Official Guide of the Railways and Steam Navigation Lines of the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Cuba. It was filled with timetables and the rather violently simplified maps of railroad companies, in which the route of the company under consideration is shown as strong and direct as possible, while all the others are very spiderweb. In odd moments, Richard would pore over this massive concordance and gathered much miscellaneous information. The names of the famous limited trains sounded to him like bugle calls in the distance. What a fascinating book it is. The old copy that first enthralled Roe is long since vanished, but Hubbard stopped in at Britano's to buy a new one. Over 1,600 pages of strong American romance for $2. His patriotism was a little startled to find advertisements of English railways in the forefront of the work, calmly announcing themselves as the fastest train service in the world. It was the smaller railroads of the Middle West or South that seemed like fairy tales to Richard, the Detroit, Toledo, and Ironton. You leave Detroit at 8:15 a.m. and arrive in Ironton at 7:05 p.m., just in time for dinner, he reflected. No passenger trains on Sundays. Or the Green Bay and Western. You would rise very early in that bright Wisconsin air and have coffee and fried ham. How clear the birch trees would stand round Lake Winnebago. And after passing through Scandinavia, Plover, Independence, Arcadia, you would be in Winona, 213.9 miles, at 2:50 p.m. Or maybe take the branch line up to Sturgeon Bay, or even more thrilling, see the dotted line across Lake Michigan. The car ferry, a magic sound, to Ludington. That would lead on toward White Cloud, Owosso, Saginaw, Ann Arbor. The names read in newspapers, or seen in the office files, or overheard in salesmen's talk, suddenly became real. The railway guide became Richard's outline of history. His story of philosophy. There was the Toledo, Peoria and Western, the Peoria Road, which doesn't seem to go near Toledo at all on its own rails, but begins at Eppner, Indiana. He found himself in imagination on a mixed train, passenger service connections uncertain, passing a long night on the way to Keokuk. Number 3 leaves Eppner at 8:30 p.m., it arrives in Peoria Yard at 5:20 a.m. There must be a chance for coffee and sinkers at Peoria Yard. And he would go out on number 103, good old number 103, at 7:45, and arrive at Keokuk, 2:30 p.m. "Is there a bookstore in Keokuk?" he asked Miss Mack. There were greater names, too. Denver and Rio Grande, the Mullen Route, more formally listed as the Chicago, Indianapolis, and Louisville. That would take you through French Lick on the Tippecanoe or the Hoosier or the Daylight Limited Observation Library car. The Norfolk and Western offers the Pocahontas and the Cavalier. Pocahontas leaves Norfolk at 1:20 p.m. and gets you to Cincinnati at 7:55 the next morning. And from the window you see Roanoke, Blue Ridge, Lynchburg, Appomattox, Disputanta. Perhaps you're on the Pocahontas, Goodwill and Winona branch. If so, stops to take revenue passengers and to leave passengers from Hagerstown and Shenandoah Junction. Surely you're a better American for brooding on those names. The Nickel Plate was a road he often heard Herman Schmaltz mention with casual familiarity. Herman, he figured out, would be leaving Fostoria at 11:35 a.m. Eastern Time and proceeding via Arcadia. You'd be surprised how many Arcadias there are. Findlay, Lima, Central Time here, Coldwater, Fort Recovery, Muncie. Probably he would stop over at Muncie before going on to Montmorency, Otterbein, Oxford, Boswell, East Lynn, Arrowsmith, Bloomington. The Père Marquette, another name to start one reading history. Again, an early start. Leave Port Huron 6 a.m. and through Teddo, Palms, Harbor Beach, Tyre, Bad Axe, to Point of Arc. Does the name Bad Axe give a vivid picture of some old lumberman's disgust, now memorized forever? The Southern timetables were rich in suggestion. He saved up many questions to ask George Work when the latter returned from his territory. Consider the minor twigs of the Chesapeake and Ohio Company, the Hawk's Nest Branch, Horse Creek Branch, Loop Creek, and White Oak Branch, Piney River and Paint Creek Branch. Or, on the luxurious side, here is the Sportsman to Old Point Comfort, observation lounge, radio equipped. That, of course, is of later era. And the FFV to White Sulphur Springs, Imperial Salon Cars. The subsidiaries of the Southern Railway, the Asheville and Craggy Mountain, the State University Railroad, the Crescent Limited to New Orleans. Women's lounge, shower bath, maid and manicure service, movable chairs, magazines, writing desk. The Ponce de Leon to Florida. Names on the map, Manassas, Brandy, Culpeper, Rapidan, Charlottesville, Sweetbriar, Windsap, Alta Vista. The steamers on the Chesapeake leave Baltimore on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday for York River landings. The Old Bay Line, table d'hôte dinner, $1.25. Dining room and gallery. Upper deck, forward. The Mobile and Ohio Seaboard Airline, the Orange Blossom Special. The Little Maryland and Pennsylvania Railroad, loved as the Ma and Pa, from Baltimore to York, Pennsylvania, 77 miles in 4.5 hours. The Aberdeen and Rockfish in North Carolina, leave Aberdeen, 8:35 a.m., arrive Fayetteville, 45 miles, 10:50. Chunk Switchback Railway, Cable and Gravity Road to Mount Pisgah, distance of circuit 18 miles, the oldest railroad in the U.S. The Cairo, Truman and Southern, in operation for freight and passenger service from Wiona Junction, Arkansas to Wiona, Arkansas, 3.83 miles. This good little outfit was evidently a family affair. President, J.H. Schutte, First Vice President, J. Schutte, Second Vice President, E.W. Schutte. Third Vice President, Philip Schutte. Treasurer and General Manager, R.H. Schutte. Secretary and Traffic Manager, Fred Schutte. Bigger game by contrast, the Atlantic coastline with its Florida Special, Palmetto Limited, the Tar Heel, New York to Wilmington, North Carolina, the Flamingo, the Dixie Flyer to Jacksonville, Illinois Central, the Creole and the Chickasaw, the MKT, always known as the Katy, proud of the blue bonnet, the Texas Special, the Katy Limited. There is no pleasanter courtesy, said the Katy, than to be invited into the diner for afternoon tea and to have the steward suggest and provide chess, checkers, or dominoes for games. Richard thought with renewed admiration of these giants of the traveling leagues who had shared such transcontinental amenities. There is no end to the lure of these names. You see the little flags fluttering, smoke pouring from squat racing funnels, the flicker of roaring wheels, taillights on a midnight curve. The Sooner, the Alamo Special, the Lone Star St. Louis Southwestern proclaims the Blue Streak, America's fastest freight train. Chicago and Northwestern is perhaps as poetic as any of its christenings. The Corn King Limited with Solarium Sleeping Car, the Mountain Bluebird, the Columbine, the Gold Coast Limited, the Portland Rose, the Nightingale, the Viking, the Badger State Express. From the Solarium Sleeping Car, greet Pocatello, Minidoka, Boise, Pendleton, Spokane, Tacoma, Seattle, or the Union Pacific, the Oregon Trail Express, the Yellowstone Express, the Pony Express, the Owl, sleepers parked in Portland for occupancy until 8 a.m. The Southern Pacific and its proud Sunset Limited and Argonauts, on which Charity, DVS Employee, Livestock Contract, Banana Messenger, and Circus Script Tickets will be honored in coaches only. The Sunbeam, the Lark, the Apache. And here he imagined ventures into Mexico. Leave El Paso 11:15 a.m. and by way of Ciudad Juarez, Montezuma, Chihuahua, Jimenez, Torreon, Aguascalientes, Querétaro. Reach Mexico City 10 a.m. 2 days later. The Santa Fe, with its Fred Harvey dining car service, Hal Sam Erskine, who used to make the coast, spoke of those royal meals. The Chief, the Navajo, the missionary. Because of late hour arrival at the petrified forest detour, trains 23 and 24 temporarily discontinued. Frequently, the Grand Canyon Limiteds are stopped at dining stations for the evening meal, offering patrons choice of dining aboard the train or at one of our artistic station hotels. Hollywood stars and the stars in every profession and business go Santa Fe and ride the Chief. Alternative temptation. Go to Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul, America's longest electrified railroad. The Olympian, the first transcontinental roller-bearing train. The Pioneer, Chicago to Minneapolis. The Sioux, the Tomahawk, or the CB&O. The Aristocrat, the American Royal, the Overland Express. The Great Northern, the Empire Builder saves a business day between Chicago and Puget Sound. The Canadian Pacific, the Dominion, the Kootenai Express, Sioux Express, the Red Wing, the Alouette, the Royal York. Wasn't there something once in Homer known as the Catalog of Ships? Was it any more thrilling than this muster of trains and stations? Sometimes, studying the railway guide, you find yourself a long way from Fifth Avenue. The railway guide, perhaps even more than the Erskine Atlas, made the curved and steel-netted surface of the earth actual to Richard. When Miss Mack saw him poring over those timetables, she knew he was a born salesman.
You've been listening to The Railway Guide, a short piece by Christopher Morley. This is Fortunato. Didn't get all the intros and exit pieces on tonight's show. We're kind of putting it together. And coming up, we're going to have our featured story, The Night Run of the Overland. But to put you in an even more train mood, let's get the boys from the Hot Club of Paris, the Hot Jazz Club of Paris, Django and Stefan out. Django Reinhardt, Mystery Train, I think that was called. Mystery Pacific, yes. This is Fortunato. You're listening to our train special, as it is here on KBOO Portland. Our featured story for tonight comes from a 1903 issue of Collier's Magazine by Elliot Peak, and is entitled The Night Run of the Overland.
It snowed. The switch lamps at Valley Junction twinkled faintly through the swirling flakes. A broad band of light from the night operator's room shot out into the gloom, and it too was thickly powdered. Aside from this, the scattered houses of the little hamlet slept in darkness, all save one. Through the drawn curtains of a cottage which squatted in the right angle formed by the intersecting tracks 100 yards or more from the station, a light shone dully. Inside, a young woman with a book in her lap sat beside a sick bed. On the bed lay a young man of perhaps 30. They were not an ordinary couple, nor of the type which prevailed in Valley Junction. The rugged strength of the man, which shone through even the pallor of sickness, was touched and softened by an unmistakable gentleness of birth, and the dark eyes which rested motionless upon the further wall were thoughtful and liquid with intelligence. The young woman was yet more striking. Her loose gown, girdled at the waist with a tasseled cord, only half concealed the sturdy, sweeping lines of the form beneath. Her placid, womanly face was crowned with a glorious mass of burnished auburn hair. Her blue eyes, now fixed solicitously upon her husband's face, were dark with what seemed to be an habitual earnestness of purpose, and her sweet mouth drooped seriously. After a moment, though, she shook off her pensive mood.
What are you thinking of, dear?
She asked with a brightening face.
Of you,
answered her husband gravely, tightening his grasp upon the hand she had slipped into his.
Comparing your life in this wretched place, Sylvia, with what it was before I married you. And thinking of that wonderful thing called love, which can make you content with the change.
The young woman bent forward with a little spasmodic movement and laid her beautiful hair upon the pillow beside her husband's dark strands. For a little she held herself in a kind of breathless tension, her hand upon his further temple, her full, passionate lips pressed tight against his cheek.
Not content, my heart's husband, but happy.
After a moment, she lifted herself and quietly smoothed her ruffled hair.
I mustn't do that again,
she said demurely.
The doctor said you were not to be excited. I guess I won't allow you to think any more on that subject either,
she added with pretty tyranny.
Only this, Ben. Papa will forgive us someday. He's good. Just give him some time. Someday you'll put away your dear foolish pride and let me write to him and tell him where we are, no matter if he did forbid it. And he'll write back, take my word for it, and say, come home, children, and be forgiven. But whether he does or not, I tell you, sweetheart, I would sooner flutter about this little dovecot of ours and ride on the engine with you on bright days than be the mistress of the finest palace Papa's money could buy.
For a moment the pair looked the love they could not speak. Then the spell was broken by the distant scream of a locomotive, half drowned in the howling wind. Sylvia glanced at the clock.
There's the Overland. She's 3 minutes late. The wind is dead against her. Someday, dear, if you want to, you will hold the throttle of that engine, and I shall be the proudest girl in the land.
With a fine unconscious loyalty to the corporation which gave them bread and butter, they listened in silence to the dull roar of the incoming train. But instead, a moment later, of the usual thunderous burst as the train swept by and the trembling of earth, they heard the grinding of brake shoes, the whistle of the air, and then, in the lull which followed, the thumping of a pump like some great, excited heart. At this unexampled occurrence, the sick man threw his wife a startled glance, and she sprang to the front window and drew back the curtain. She was just turning away again, still unsatisfied, when there came a quick, imperative rap at the door. Instantly connecting this rap with the delayed train, Sylvia flung the door wide open, revealing three men, the foremost of whom she recognized as the night operator at the junction.
Mrs. Fox, this is the general superintendent, Mr.
My name is Howard, madam,
said the official for himself, unceremoniously pushing forward.
We're in trouble. Our engineer had a stroke of apoplexy 15 miles back, and I want your husband to take this train. I know he's sick, but...
But he's too sick, sir, to hold his head up.
What's the trouble?
Called Fox sharply from his bed. An instant's hush fell over the little group at the door, and then they all, as if moved by one impulse, filed quickly back to the sick room.
Mr. Fox, I hate to ask a sick man to get out of bed and pull a train, but we're tied up here hard and fast with not another engineer in sight, and every minute that train stands there, the company loses $1,000. If you can pull her through to Stockton, it'll be the best 2 hours' work that you ever did. I will give you $500.
Fox had at first risen to his elbow, but now he sank back, dizzy and trembling from weakness. In a moment, though, he was up again.
I can't do it, Mr. Howard. I'm too sick. If it weren't a physical impossibility, if I weren't too dizzy to hold my head up...
He broke off abruptly and pressed his hand in a dazed way to his brow. Then he fixed his excited eyes upon his wife. The other men followed his gaze, plainly regarding him as out of his head. But Sylvia turned pale and leaned against the wall for support. She had caught her husband's meaning.
She'll take the train, sir. And she'll take it through safe. She knows an engine as well as I. And every inch of the road. Sylvia, you must go. It is your duty.
The superintendent, staggered at this amazing proposition,
what?
Gasped and stared at the young woman.
I don't know.
She stood with her dilated eyes fastened upon her husband, her chest rising and falling, and blood-red tongues of returning color shooting through her cheeks. Yet even in that crucial moment, when her little heart was fluttering like a wounded bird, something in Sylvia's eye, something hard and stubborn, fixed the skeptical superintendent's attention. And he drew a step nearer.
Well...
Sylvia, with twitching nostrils and swelling throat, turned upon him almost desperately.
I will go,
she said in a low, resigned voice.
But someone must stay here with him.
This young man will attend to all that, never fret,
cried Howard gaily in his relief, turning to the night operator.
Don't worry about a thing, ma'am. I'll look after him.
Whatever doubts the superintendent may have harbored yet of the fair engineer's nerve and skill were plainly removed when Sylvia returned from an inner room after an absence of scarcely 60 seconds.
Well, I'll be...
An indomitable courage was stamped upon her handsome features, and she bore herself with the firm, subdued mien of one who knows the gravity of her task, yet has faith in herself for its performance. One of her husband's caps was drawn tightly over her thick hair. She had slipped into a short walking skirt, and as she advanced, she calmly but swiftly buttoned her jacket. Without hesitation, she stepped to the bedside and kissed her husband.
Be brave, girl. You've got to make 75 miles an hour, or better. But you've got the machine to do it with. Give her her head on all the grades except 4 Mile Creek. Don't be afraid, and give her a little sand on Beechtree Hill. Goodbye, and God keep you.
Sylvia stood beneath a great black hulk of iron and steel which drew the overland, compared with which her husband's little local engine was but a toy, and glanced down the long line of mail, express, and sleeping cars laden with human freight. Her heart almost failed her again. The mighty boiler towered high above her in the darkness like the body of some horrible antediluvian monster, and the steam rushed angrily from the dome as though the great animal were fretting under an unaccountable delay, and longed to be off again on the wings of the wind, rending the tempest with its iron snout and awakening the sleeping hills and hollows with its hoarse shriek.
You're a brave little woman,
she heard the superintendent saying at the cab step.
Don't lose your nerve, but make time. Whatever else you do, every minute you make up is money in the company's pocket, and they won't forget it. Besides, we've got a big gun on board. And I want you to show him that a little thing like this don't frustrate us any. If you draw into Stockton on time, I'll add $500 to that check. Remember that.
And he lifted her up to the cab. The fireman, a young Irishman, stared at Sylvia as she stepped into the cab as though she were a banshee. But she made no explanations, and after a glance at the steam and water gauges, climbed up to the engineer's high seat. The hand she laid upon the throttle lever trembled slightly, as well it might. The huge iron horse quivered and stiffened, as if bracing itself for its task. Noiselessly and imperceptibly it moved ahead, expelled one mighty breath, then another, and another, quicker and quicker, shorter and shorter, until its respirations were lost in one continuous flow of steam. The overland was once more underway. The locomotive responded to Sylvia's touch with an alacrity which seemed almost human, and which, familiar as though she was with the work, thrilled her through and through. She glanced at the timetable. They were 12 minutes behind time. The 20 miles between the junction and Grafton lay in a straight, level line. Sylvia determined to use it to good purpose and to harden herself at once, as indeed she must, to the dizzy speed required by the inexorable schedule. She threw the throttle wide open and pushed the reverse lever into the last notch. The great machine seemed suddenly animated with a demonic energy, and soon they were shooting through the black, storm-beaten night like an avenging bolt from the hand of a colossal god. The headlight, so dazzling from in front, so insufficient from behind, danced feebly ahead upon the driving cloud of snow. That was all. The track was illuminated for scarcely 50 feet, and the night yawned beyond like some engulfing abyss. Sylvia momentarily closed her eyes and prayed that no unfortunate creature, human or brute, might wander that night between the rails. The fireman danced attendance on the fire, watching his heat and water as jealously as a doctor might watch the pulse of a fever patient. Now the furnace door was closed, now it hung on its latch, now it was closed again, and now, when the ravenous maw within cried for more coal, it was flung wide open, lighting the driving cloud of steam and smoke above with a spectral glare. Sylvia worked with the fireman with a fine intelligence which only the initiated could understand. For an engine is a steed whose speed depends upon its driver. She opened or closed the injector to economize heat and water and eased the steam when it could be spared. Thus, together, they coaxed, cajoled, threatened, and goaded the wheeled monster until, like a veritable thing of life, it seemed to strain every nerve to do their bidding and whirled them faster and faster. Yet, as they flashed through Grafton, scarcely distinguishable in the darkness and the storm, they were still 10 minutes behind time. Sylvia shut her lips tightly. If it was necessary to defy death on the curves and grades ahead, defy death she would. Sticky snow on her glass now cut off Sylvia's vision ahead. It mattered little, for her life and the lives of the sleeping passengers behind were in higher hands than hers, and only the all-seeing eye could see that night. Another train ahead, an open switch, a fallen rock or tree, one awful crash, and the engine would become a gridiron for her tender flesh, while the palatial cars behind, now so full of warmth and light and comfort, would suddenly be turned into mere shapeless heaps of death. And Sylvia cautiously opened her door a little, held it firmly against the hurricane while she brushed off the snow. At the same time, she noticed that the headlight was burning dim.
The headlight's covered with snow,
she called to the fireman. The young fellow instantly drew his cap tighter, braced himself, and swung open his door. At the first cruel blast, the speed of which was that of the gale added to that of the train, he closed his eyes and held his breath. Then, taking his life in his hands, he slipped out upon the wet, treacherous running board of the pitching locomotive, made his way forward, and cleared the glass. Sylvia waited with bated breath until his head appeared in the door again.
Fire up, please,
she exclaimed nervously, for the steam had fallen off a pound. As the twinkling street lamps of Nancyville came into view, Sylvia blew a long blast. But there was no tuneful reverberation among the hills that night. The wind, like some ferocious beast of prey, pounced upon the sound and throttled it in the teeth of the whistle. The foxes shopped in Nancyville. They could shop 50 miles from home as easily as 50 rods. And the town, by comparison with Valley Junction, was beginning to seem like a little city to Sylvia. But tonight, sitting at the helm of that transcontinental train, which burst upon the town like a cyclone with a shriek and a roar and then was gone all again in a breath, she scarcely recognized the place. It seemed little and rural and mean to her, a mere eddy in the world's great current. One third of the 149 miles was now gone, and still the overland was 10 minutes behind, and it seemed as if no human power could make up the time. They were winding through the Tallulah Hills, where the road was as crooked as a serpent's trail. The engine jerked viciously from side to side, as if angrily resenting the pitiless goading from behind, and twice Sylvia was nearly thrown from her seat. The wheels savagely ground the rails at every curve, and it made them shriek in agony. One side of the engine first mounted upward like a ship upon a wave, then suddenly sank, as if engulfed. One instant, Sylvia was lifted high above her fireman, the next dropped far below him. Yet she dared not slacken speed. The cry of time, time, time was dinned into her ears with every stroke of the piston. Her train was but one wheel, nay, but one cog of one wheel, in the vast and complicated machine of transportation. Yet one slip of that cog would rudely jar the whole delicate mechanism from coast to coast. Indeed, in Sylvia's excited fancy, the spirit of worldwide commercialism seemed riding on the gale above her, like Odin of old in the Wild Hunt, urging her on and on. Something of all this was in the mind of the fireman, too, in a simpler way. And when he glanced at his gentle superior from time to time, as she clung desperately to the armrest with one hand and clutched the reverse lever with the other, with white, set face, but firm mouth and fearless eye, his blue eyes flashed with a chivalric fire. Dashed into Carbondale, and Sylvia made out ahead the glowing headlight of the eastbound train, sidetracked and waiting for the belated overland, her engineer and conductor, doubtless, fuming and fretting. The first time during the run, Sylvia allowed a morbid, nervous fear to take hold of her.
Suppose the switch were open.
She knew that it must be closed, but the sickening possibility presented itself over and over again, with its train of horrors in the brief space of a few seconds. She held her breath, and half closed her eyes as they thundered down upon the other train. And when the engine lurched a little as it struck the switch, her heart leaped into her mouth. The suspense was mercifully short, though, for in an instant, as it were, they were past the danger, past the town, and once more scouring the open country. In spite of the half-pipe of sand which she let run as they climbed Beechtree Hill, the last of the Tallulahs, it seemed to Sylvia as if they would never reach the summit, and as if the locomotive had lost all its vim. Yet the speed was slow only by contrast, and in reality was terrific, and the tireless steed upon whose high haunch Sylvia was perched was doing the noblest work of the night. At last, though, the high level of the barren plains was gained, and for 40 miles, which were reeled off in less than 30 minutes, they swept along like an albatross on the crest of a gale, smoothly and almost noiselessly. Sylvia suspected that the engine was doing no better right here than it did every night of the year, and that went on time. Yet when she glanced from the timetable to the clock, as they clicked over the switch points of Melrose with a force which seemed sufficient to snap them off like icicles, she was chagrined to discover that they were still 8 minutes behind. They were now approaching the long 12-mile descent of Four Mile Creek, with a beautiful level stretch at the bottom through the Spirit River Valley. Sylvia came to a grim determination. Half a dozen times previously, she had wondered, in her unfamiliarity with heavy trains and their magnificent speed, as if she were falling short of or exceeding the safety limit. And half a dozen times, she had been on the point of appealing to the firemen. But her pride, even in that momentous crisis, had restrained her. And moreover, the timetable, mutely urging her faster and faster, seemed answer enough. But just before they struck the grade, the responsibility of her determination, contrary, too, to her husband's advice, seemed too much to bear alone.
I'm going to let her have her head,
she cried out in her distress. The fireman did not answer. Perhaps he did not hear. And setting her teeth, Sylvia assumed the grim burden alone. The ponderous locomotive fell over the brow of the hill with her throttle agape and the fire seething in her vitals with volcanic fury. Then she lowered her head like a maddened bull in his charge. The long, heavy train, sweeping down the sharp descent, might fitly have been likened to some winged dragon flying low to earth, so appallingly flight-like was the motion. It seemed to Sylvia as though they dropped down the grade as an airlight drops from heaven, silent, irresistible, awful, touched only by the circumambient air. All Sylvia's familiar methods of gauging speed were now at fault, for she believed that for the moment they were running 2 miles to every minute. The thought that a puny human hand, a woman's hand, could stay that grand momentum seemed wildly absurd, and as Sylvia, under the strange lassitude born of her deadly peril, relaxed her tense muscles and drowsily closed her eyes, she smiled with a ghastly humor at the trust of the sinking passengers in her. She was rudely shaken out of her lethargy as the train struck a slight curve halfway down the grade. The locomotive shied like a frightened steed and shook in every iron muscle. The flanges shrieked against the rails, the cab swayed and cracked, and the very earth seemed to tremble. For a moment, the startled girl was sure that they were upon the ties or had at least lost a wheel. But it was only the terrible momentum lifting them momentarily from the track, and in a few seconds, though every second meant 150 feet, the fire-eating behemoth righted itself. Yet its beautiful equilibrium was gone, and as if abandoning itself to its driver's mad mood, the engine rolled and pitched and rose and fell like a waterlogged vessel in a storm. The bell, catching upon the motion, began to toll, and the dolorous sound, twisted into weird discord by the gale, fell upon the ears of the pallid engineer and fireman like the notes of a storm-tossed bellboy, sounding the knell of the doomed. The young fireman, who up to this time had maintained a stoical calm, suddenly sprang to the floor of the cab, with a face torn by superstitious fear.
"What if she leaves the rails?"
he cried. But instantly recovering himself, he sprang back to his seat with the blood of shame on his cheeks.
"Am I running too fast?
No one were behind time!"
he doggedly shouted back. As the train became smoother, the engine grew calmer, but its barred tongue licking up the flying space for many a minute before the momentum of that perilous descent was lost. As the roar of their passage over the long bridge spanning the Matunk, 20 miles from Stockton, died away, the fireman called out cheerily,
"On time, madam!"
His voice reached Sylvia's swimming ears faint and distant as she nodded dizzily on her seat, bracing herself against the reverse lever. Meanwhile, in the general superintendent's private car, at the extreme rear of the train, a party of men still sat up, smoking their Havanas and sipping their wine. One member of this party was the big gun mentioned to Sylvia by the general superintendent, the president of the Mississippi Valley, Omaha, and Western Railway. He was a large man with luxuriant snow-white hair, and though his face was benevolent, even paternal, every line of it betrayed the inflexible will which had lifted its owner from the roof of a freight car to the presidential chair of a great road. Mr. Howard, the general superintendent, was regaling the party with an account of his experience in securing a substitute engineer at Valley Junction. For reasons afterwards divulged, he suppressed, though, the most startling feature of his story, namely the sex of the engine runner he had secured. But he compensated his hearers for this omission with a most dramatic account of the heroism of the sick man, whom he unblushingly represented as having risen from his bed and taken charge of the engine. Mr. Staniford, the distinguished guest, listened quietly until Howard was done.
"Charlie, you are a heartless wretch,"
he observed, smiling. And when Howard protested, with a twinkle in his eye, that there was no other way, the president added,
"If it had been on my road, I should have held the train all night rather than drag a sick man from his bed."
"We all know how many trains are held all night on your road, Staniford. Do you happen to remember the story of an ambitious young engineer who picked himself up out of a wreck with a broken arm and stepped into a new engine and pulled his train through to the end of the run?"
"I was young then and working for glory. No superintendent ordered me to do it, or I should probably have refused. These engineers are a heroic set. Charlie, I sometimes think we don't always do them justice."
"I'll do this one justice."
Party dropped off to bed, one by one. The general superintendent himself finally rose and looked at his watch. As he turned and made his way forward, his careless expression gave way to one of concern. His mind was evidently on the gentle engine runner. Possibly he had recurring doubts of her skill and courage, but perhaps the fact that he had daughters of his own gave his thought, as much as anything else, a graver turn. Three cars ahead, he met the conductor, who also seemed a little nervous, and they talked together for some moments. The train, at the time, was snapping around the choppy curves in the Tallulah Hills like the flash of a whip, and the two men had difficulty keeping their feet.
"Fast, but not too fast, Dawkins."
"What I call a high safety."
"A fearful in the cab, eh?"
"Nothing equal to it, sir."
Howard started back toward the private car about the time the train struck Beechtree Hill. He paused in a vestibule, opened the door, and laid his practiced ear to the din outside. Then he gently closed the door, as if to slam it might break the spell, and complacently smiled. When the train reached the level of barren plains, and the sleepers ceased their swaying and settled down to a smooth, straightaway motion, that sure annunciator of high speed, the superintendent rubbed his palms together very much like a man shaking hands with himself. When he got back to his car, he found Mr. Staniford still up, smoking, and leaning back in the luxurious seat with half-closed eyes. Staniford motioned Howard to sit down beside him and laid his hand familiarly on the latter's knee.
"Confound you, Charlie. You've got that sick engineer on my heart now. With your inflammatory descriptions, for which you probably drew largely on your imagination, I've been sitting here thinking about him now. Confess, you exaggerated matters a little."
"Well, I did in one respect, but in another, I fell short. Staniford, I've got the best railroad story to give the papers that has been brought out in years. And if I don't get several thousand dollars worth of free advertising out of it, my name isn't C.W. Howard. And the best of it, it's the gospel truth.
Well, let's have it.
Well, between you and me, that man Fox was a mighty sick man.
Wait a minute. Sick to... Did you say Fox?
Yes.
What's his first name?
Oh, I don't know. He's a tall, smooth-faced fella with dark hair and eyes. Rather intelligent-looking. What do you know about him? He's a comparatively new man with us.
I don't know that I know him, but if he's the man I have in mind, he's all right. Go on.
He ever run on your road?
Yes, yes. That's got nothing to do with it. Just go on.
Well, he was altogether too sick to pull a plug, but it seems that his wife was been in the habit of riding with him and knows the road and an engine as well as he does. And to come to the point, and this is my story, which I didn't tell the boys for the sake of their nerves, the Overland at this moment is in the hands of a girl, sir. Fox's wife.
It seemed a long time before either man spoke again. Howard stared in blank amazement at the pallid face of the president, unable to understand the old railroader's agitation and unwilling to attribute it to fear of being in the hands of an engineer who might lose her head. Then Staniford took the other's hand and held it in an iron grip.
Charlie, it's my own little baby girl.
Howard was familiar with the story of the elopement of Staniford's daughter with one of the M, V, O, and W engineers, and the situation flashed over him in an instant. After a moment, during which, as he afterwards confessed, he could not keep his mind off the added sensation this new fact would give his advertising story, he said enthusiastically,
"She's a heroine, Staniford, and worthy of her father."
During the perilous descent of Four Mile Creek, the private car rocked like a cradle, cracked and snapped in every point. Staniford hung helplessly to Howard's hands, with the tears trickling down his cheeks. When the bottom was at last reached and the danger was over, the danger at the front, the president drew his handkerchief and wiped the great drops of sweat from his brow. The ex-engineer knew the agony through which his child had passed. The operator at Valley Junction had flashed the news along the wire, and when the Overland steamed up to the Union Depot in Stockton at 1:07, 20 seconds ahead of time, a curious and enthusiastic throng of layover passengers and railroad men pressed around the engine. When Sylvia appeared in the gangway, her glorious sun-kissed hair glistening with melted snow and her pale face streaked with soot, the generous crowd burst into yells of applause. The husky old veteran runner who was to take the girl's place stepped forward by virtue of his office, as it were, and lifted Sylvia down. For a moment she reeled, partly from faintness, partly from the sickness caused by the pitching of the locomotive. Then she saw, pushing unceremoniously through the throng, the general superintendent and, she started and looked again, her father. When President Staniford, struggling to control his emotion, clasped his daughter to his bosom, her overstrained nerves gave way under the double excitement, and laying her head wearily upon his shoulder, and with her hands upon his neck, she began to cry in a choked, pitiful little way.
Oh, Papa, call me your dear little redhead once more.
You've been listening to The Night Run of the Overland by Elliot Peak, originally from Collier's Magazine, 1907, 1903, something like that. I was able to find that story on the Internet. If you look up Railway Stories, there's a whole site with a bunch of other stuff from the golden age of railway fiction. In our 3D radio players, ooh, who did we have here? We had Payne's Gray was our narrator. Of the return of Abergene Plum as our heroine. Woody Creek was in there. Van Dyke Brown. Yours truly, Fortunato. And somebody we just dragged in off the studio, here in the studio just this afternoon to take one of the parts there. The kid, we would have to call him. Thanks for doing it. We're going to use that guy again, I'm sure. Some of the music, we had Vaughan Williams from a couple of British soundtracks, and we had Aaron Copland. The guitar solo in the early part with the Debussy music was Johnny Hammond Smith, a jazz artist. And we also had music from a soundtrack album that's for silent movie music. Well, let's see here. We were in a kind of railway, sentimental, dad kind of mood here.
Daddy, what's a train? Is it something I can ride? Does it carry lots of grown-up folks and little kids inside? Is it bigger than our house? Well, how can I explain when my little boy asked me, Daddy, what's a train? When I was just a boy, living by the track, us kids that gather up the coal in a big old gunny sack. Then we heard the warning sound as the train pulled into view. The engineer had smiling wave as she went rolling through. She blew so loud and clear, we had to cover up our ears. And we counted cars just as high as we could go. I can almost hear the steam and the big old driver scream. But the sound my little boy will never know. Daddy, what's a train? Is it something I can ride? Does it carry lots of grown-up folks and little kids inside? Is it bigger than our house? Well, how can I explain when my little boy asks me, Daddy, what's a train? I guess the times have changed. Kids are different now. Some don't even seem to know that milk comes from a cow. My little boy can tell the names of all the baseball stars. I remember how he memorized the names on railroad cars. The Wabash and the TP, Lackawanna and the IC. Yeah, the nickel plate, the good old Santa Fe. Just names out of the past, I guess they're fading fast. Every time I hear my little boy say, Daddy, what's a train? Is it something I can ride? Does it carry lots of grown-up folks and little kids inside? Is it bigger than our house? Well, how can I explain when my little boy asked me, Daddy, what's a train? We climbed into the car and drove down into town. Right up to the depot house, but no one was around. We searched the yard together for something I could show. But I knew there hadn't been a train for a dozen years or so. All the things I did when I was just a kid, how far away those old memories appear. I guess it's plain to see, they still mean a lot to me. Because my ambition was to be an engineer. Daddy, what's a train? Is it something I can ride? Does it carry lots of grown-up folks and little kids inside? Is it bigger than our house? Well, how can I explain when my little boy asked me, Daddy, what's a train?
Utah Phillips with Daddy, What's a Train? This is off of an album called Good Through. Also on this album was one of the trains I used in the story. And this is the Nickel Plate Road number 759. Gremlin Time here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. I hear that down in the southeast Portland lately, near the Brooklyn Yards, I've been hearing them steam trains coming through here. Ooh. And just recently, Amtrak has added another line up to between Portland and Seattle. This is Oliver Nelson, Hobo Flats. We'll be right back. Oliver Nelson with Hobo Flats. Well, Gremlin Time will be back next month. We're going to have a noir thriller by Cornell Woolrich entitled The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. So tune in next month on the third Monday for the Midtime Radio Show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time. We're going to get on out of here with some Ray Bryant from Slow Freight. So long, see you next time.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club.